Lecture 5. Where is General American English?
Where is Standard American English spoken? When I ask my students that question, they usually respond with, in the Midwest, in the West, or that's what I speak. Well, which is it? Is Standard American English a regional dialect spoken somewhere in the Midwest or West? Or is it non-regional or a-regional, having more to do with getting a university education than with where you grow up? And what do we mean by standard, anyway? There's no single codified standard for American English. There's no language academy like in France, or guide for received or accepted pronunciations like in England. So maybe a better term is general American English, the type of English we think of when we think of newscasters or important public officials like U.S. presidents. Well, maybe not presidents, since in recent decades a lot of them have had recognizably Southern accents, but you get the idea. So where is general American English? Where did it come from, and when did it arise? As we examine these questions, we need to explore the development of American English as it moved from the East Coast into the Midland and West. You'll remember that during the period of westward expansion, the 1800s, Americans were developing and adopting American language standards, not so much British anymore. But just what was the standard general language variety that people were aspiring toward? There are at least three theories for where and when general American English arose. Theory 1. General American English is New England English, Yankee English. New England had been a coherent dialect area since the earliest foundations of English in America, and it spread westward in a remarkably coherent way, especially the Western New England subdialect. Eastern New England was still a bit more eastwardly oriented toward the sea, toward interaction with England. The Yankee settlements of New England were successful, and they were well regarded, especially, some would argue, by the Yankees themselves. We'll have more on this in a minute. The Yankee population was mostly urban, relatively wealthy, and its people were industrious and well-organized into coherent communities, many of which centered on churches. They were eager to move westward, to take over new territory. And when they moved, they tended to move in entire congregations, sometimes even entire towns. The Yankees established schools and colleges as they moved into the Midwest and West, and they took their pride in their language norms. They regarded their dialect as pure English, retained intact since the days of the first Puritan settlers. Of course, it actually wasn't. Eastern New England had changed along with British English. They adopted the received pronunciations that came into vogue in the late 1700s, including the Arliss pronunciations that still typify Boston speech to this day. In Western New England, people retained their R's and other pre-RP pronunciations, but their dialect had been changing in other ways, so it wasn't Shakespearean English either. At any rate, all the ingredients were in place for the widespread promulgation of Northeastern speechways westward across the northern U.S., and the promotion of the New England dialect as standard or general American English. Yankee speech was held in high regard, and its spread was supported by strong communities and by a very positive attitude toward Yankee culture more generally. In fact, the New Englanders who pushed westward in the 1800s tended to hold themselves above other regional and cultural groups. They tended to carry over the Puritan mindset that the wilderness was the domain of Satan and it was their duty to conquer it. They were ethnocentric and they were elitists. And they had an attitude that would later be called Yankee cultural imperialism. According to linguist Timothy C. Fraser, this attitude went hand in hand with Yankee linguistic imperialism. Henry Ward Beecher was a prominent New England clergyman and abolitionist, and he was the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. He had this to say of his fellow New Englanders and what they held to be their manifest destiny to take over the U.S. We are to have the charge of this continent, and this continent is to be from this time forth governed by northern men with northern ideals and with a northern gospel. But as New Englanders were moving westward, so were southerners, and there were tensions between the two groups. New Englanders looked down on southerners. They saw them as uneducated and indolent. Catherine Beecher, another of Henry's sisters, urged young New England women to become school teachers to combat what she called the fearful scourge of ignorance pervading the West as non-New Englanders joined in the movement westward. Perhaps in part due to a sense of entitlement, and certainly due to a lot of hard work and perseverance, Northeastern speech, especially that of Western New England, spread westward across the U.S., all the way to the Pacific Northwest. In fact, settlers from New England were once so prevalent on the Oregon coast that Native Americans in the area once referred to all white people as Bostons. To this day, the Pacific Northwest is a relatively coherent dialect area, even though much of the West is more dialectally mixed. Some of the New England dialect features that came to characterize the Northern dialect area include a pronunciation difference in word pairs like horse, the animal, and horse, the way you sound when you have a sore throat. In much of the U.S., these words sound the same, horse and horse, but traditionally in New England and the North, it was horse for the animal and harse for the scratchy voice. There's also greasy for greasy and root for root. You can probably tell I'm not a Yankee because these pronunciations don't come very naturally for me. Yankee lexical items that moved westward include terms like pail, as opposed to southern bucket, and the word eavesdrop for gutter. And finally, there were Yankee grammatical features. One of the more interesting is the use of dove rather than dived for past tense dive. This is a rare example of a case of a historically regular past tense verb changing into an irregular verb. Usually things go the other way around. As a rule, we prefer regular verbs since we don't have to memorize them. We can just follow the regular pattern. In the history of English, countless formerly irregular verbs have become regular. So forms like wort, work, wrought, help, hope, and crow, crew, as in the rooster crew this morning. We don't hear that anymore. Only a handful go the other way. For example, wear, wore, string, strung, and dig, dug. In the case of dive, dove, it's probably by analogy to historically irregular verbs like drive, drove. At any rate, the New England dialect and its component features spread west across the northern U.S. in a fairly coherent manner, along with coherent, cohesive communities and a sense of cultural and linguistic correctness. So maybe correct American English comes from Yankee English. Maybe we can trace its roots all the way back to the Puritan settlements of the early 1600s. Or maybe not. The second theory for where general American English comes from is that it was born of the early dialect mix in Philadelphia, the Mid-Atlantic and points westward, the U.S. Midland dialect area. The Mid-Atlantic area was a mix of dialects from northerly areas of the British Isles, northern England, Scotland, Ireland, and of course Scots-Irish from Northern Ireland. Added to the mix were continental European languages like German and Dutch, and the Celtic languages of the British Isles, Gaelic, sometimes called Scots Gaelic, Irish, and Welsh. Even more mixing took place as people from the Middle States moved westward, as they were joined by people from the U.S. North and South. In some places, these three concurrent streams of settlement resulted in a three-tiered dialect pattern, not only across, but even within Midwestern states. For example, some dialect maps clearly show a North, Midland, and South in Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. If you happen to live in one of these states, you've probably noticed that there are dialect lines, especially between the North and South, or at least the South and everything else. Sometimes the straight lines are interrupted by unexpected pockets of southern speech in more northerly areas and more northern speech in more southerly areas. The Hoosier apex is an area of southern speech radiating upward from Kentucky into Indiana and Illinois, and there's also an apex in Missouri coming up from Arkansas. Conversely, the Western Reserve in northeastern Ohio is a longstanding pocket of New England speech in a state that's largely dominated by Southern and Midland dialects. Despite these pockets of relatively homogeneous speech, most of the Midland is mixed, and the mixing just keeps intensifying as English moves ever westward during the course of the 1800s. Now, recall that dialect contact often leads to the leveling out of dialect differences, to the creation of a somewhat simplified language variety that can be widely used and widely understood, a so-called Koine. And what better candidate for a national standard for general American English than just such a vehicle of wider communication? So maybe general American English comes from a Midland Koine. Well, there's one more theory, and this one may have the most traction. But let me keep you in suspense for just a bit. Before getting into the third possibility, Let's talk briefly about the westward expansion of one dialect that no one nowadays would identify as General American English, and that's Southern English. In general terms, Southerners in their dialects moved westward across the South, just like Northerners in their speech moved across the North. But we've already learned that attitudes toward Southern speech weren't quite the same, not by a long shot. Also in the South, there were a couple different streams of settlement. People from more northerly areas of the coastal South, Virginia and North Carolina, had already moved into Tennessee and Kentucky by the latter part of the 1700s. From there, they would move into southern Missouri and northern Arkansas. People from more southerly areas, South Carolina and Georgia, began moving inland a bit later, in the early 1800s. In 1829, a gold rush in the mountains of northern Georgia prompted further population movements. Miners pushed for the removal of Native Americans from the area. This contributed to the enactment of the Indian Removal Act of 1830. This resulted in the displacement of more than 45,000 Native Americans from their homelands east of the Mississippi along the so-called Trail of Tears. Eventually, as Native Americans were pushed out, English-speaking settlement in the lower South would extend into southern Alabama, Mississippi, and points westward. And let's not forget another very important population group in the South, slaves of West African descent. Slavery had been practiced in the American colonies since long before American independence, and slaves were prevalent in coastal areas, in plantations and smaller farms, in the late 1700s and early 1800s. In 1794, an important development occurred that helped push slaves westward along with their British descended owners. This was the invention of the cotton gin, a mechanized means for processing cotton that made the cotton industry much more profitable. It also enabled farm owners to move away from coastal rice and indigo plantations to cotton fields in the interior South. And as plantations moved inland, they expanded, and the slave population increased dramatically. By way of example, let's consider Georgia alone. Believe it or not, there was an early ban on slavery during the colonial period, between 1735 and 1751. In fact, Georgia was the only American colony to ever have such a ban. But it was relatively short-lived, and once it was lifted, the number of slaves in coastal Georgia increased very quickly, from only about 500 in 1751 to approximately 18,000 in 1775. And once the cotton gin came in, there were even greater increases. Between 1820 and 1840, the number of slaves in Georgia went from about 150,000, already really high, to a full 280,000. So clearly, there were lots of African languages and descendants of speakers of these languages in the Southern American dialect mix. As the South moved inland, it developed sub-dialects. Some dialectologists draw a dialect line between the Upper South and Lower South due to the different settlement patterns and population mixes in each sub-region. And there's widespread agreement that there's an important sub-dialect called the Mountain South or Inland South. This encompasses the Appalachian Mountain areas of eastern Tennessee, western North Carolina, and northern Alabama. There's also the Texas South. Both of these areas were populated by people of Irish and Scots-Irish descent, so dialect roots in northern British rather than the southern British and West African influences that shaped the dialects of much of the rest of the American South. And these sub-areas were also characterized by distinctive cultural identities. Most Americans are well aware that Texas has long had a very strong sense of its own unique identity. When it first gained independence from Mexico, it was its own sovereign republic for 10 whole years. And even today, Texans sometimes express a desire to secede from the U.S. and become their own state again. Now, what sorts of dialect features do we think of when we think of Southern American English? Pronunciation features are prominent. R-lessness and pronunciations like due for due, tune for tune, Tuesday for Tuesday. Interestingly, though, what we think of as quintessential Southern vowel pronunciations like tam and rad and the Southern drawl, lengthened pronunciations like bayed for bed, fish for fish, these all seem to be newer creations. Pronunciations like tam and tad probably didn't arise until the second half of the 19th century. And in fact, their spread is still underway. Recall that the I vowel in words like time is a diphthong or two-part vowel. So I is composed of A and E, A-E, I-E, I. When I is pronounced as A, as in tam and tad, for time and tide, the diphthong has been reduced to a single vowel, A. In much of the South, the monophthongization of I still doesn't extend to all I words. So alongside words like tam and tad, we have tight for tight, not tat, and nice for nice, not nass. Really, it's only in the inland South and Texas South that I monophthongization extends to all linguistic contexts. That's why people sometimes stereotype a strong Appalachian accent with phrases like nass, wat, ras, for nice white rice. Also, what we think of as a quintessentially Southern feature, Southern R-lessness, never really covered the whole South, just coastal areas more connected to England. And nowadays, R-lessness has all but faded away from the Southern U.S. and from America in general. Its last stronghold is the Boston area, with its longstanding ties to British English norms. Pronunciations like tune for tune are also receding, and so is another feature we might associate with the South, the pronunciation of WH words with hua, as in which or why. Nowadays, most Americans pronounce these words like I do, which and why. So in some ways, Southern American features are receding, but in other ways, the South has gotten more distinctive over the course of the 19th century and into the 20th and 21st, as we'll see later. Thinking more toward the West, some dialectologists also point to the California South as an early Southwestern dialect hub. English didn't really take root there until after 1850, but then it quickly took hold, and by 1880, Los Angeles was already a thriving population center. San Francisco also sprung up quickly as English speakers poured in with the Gold Rush of 1849 and the opening of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869. Other important dialect elements in California were colonial Spanish and the languages of Asians who traveled eastward across the Pacific for economic opportunity. Okay, so we've traced American English from New England across the North to the Pacific Northwest, from the mid-Atlantic coast and into the heartland, and down into the Appalachians in central Texas, and from the southeastern states westward across the South, all the way to California. So now let's get back to our search for general American English. What exactly was English leveling toward as it moved westward in the 1800s? Toward New England English, the Midland mixed dialect, or something else? There's a third theory that holds that general American English does come from a Koine, but not the colonial Midland Koine, but a newer Koine, one that arose after 1800 in the interior U.S. In his detailed discussion of the stages of development of New English dialects, linguist Edgar Schneider proposes that American English was characterized by two periods of Koine formation, Koineization, each with its own distinct character. After all, America's a big country, and English was well established on the East Coast, well into its third stage of development, endonormative stabilization, by the time it entered its first foundational stages in the West. So it's possible that there was an early colonial Koine and then a later Koine born of intensified dialect mixing as English moved into the Midland and from there into the West. Now, we've just been talking about how non-generic Southern American speech is, but according to Schneider, the first general American English may actually have been more Southern in character. Rarely do we find early travelers to the colonies writing about Southern American English, but only about New England. Remember how disparaging Englanders once were of what would later become the imperious Yankee dialect? In contrast, the English of the early South mostly escaped notice. Maybe because back then it was the neutral variety, something of the general American English of its day. The post-1800s dialect mix most likely originated in the North, which is not to say that the general American English is Yankee English, but only that Yankee English may have been one of its ingredients. Sociolinguists agree that dialect mixing and leveling did take place in Upper New York State. The area was populated by speakers from different New England dialect areas, including Maine, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Western Connecticut. and the Erie Canal brought in lots of other people, including both native English speakers from elsewhere in the U.S. and non-native speakers. The dialect and language contact that characterized Upper New York State in the early 1800s could have readily led to dialect mixing, language contact, and the dialect simplification and leveling that go along with them. Sociolinguist William LaBeouf points to at least one such simplification in his detailed descriptions of the upstate New York dialect mix. Dialect contact in this area brought together speakers with several different, rather complicated rule systems governing the variable pronunciation of the A vowel in words like bad and man. Remember, dialect features have rules too, just like features deemed to be part of the standard. At any rate, when different pronunciation systems come together, they can clash and people can get confused, and so they simplify them down into one system. So the new, easier rule for a becomes this. Pronounce a as a in most words, but when it comes before m, n, or ing sounds, pronounce it more like, almost like a, as in something like main for man or bang for bang. This rule now is quite general in American English. My pronunciations are a bit of an exaggeration, but many of us have a slightly different a sound in bad versus ban. Some East Coast cities still retain more complicated systems for a. So, for example, in Philadelphia, not only is there a contrast between man and sad, there's even a contrast that's impossible to predict based on what sounds follow the a. You just have to grow up internalizing the rule. So some words ending in da, in the letter D, have a, so mad, bad, glad, while others have a, sad, had, and dad. Can you hear the difference? Now, all of this may sound pretty esoteric, but the factors that go into the reduction versus retention of dialect differences actually turn out to be pretty important in the ongoing development of dialects in the U.S. as we move from the endonormative stabilization stage to the differentiation stage. And this is where dialect differences are re-emphasized and new dialects are created. So the mixed level dialect of Western New England and points immediately westward could have been the basis for a Koine that spread from its area of origin into the northern Midwest and from there throughout the West. And this could very well be the basis for today's general American English. Not New England Yankee speech per se, but a New England area mixed dialect, simplified, leveled, and readily adoptable by many people across a wide area. So, three possibilities for where general American English originated. Yankee English, pure and simple, an early mid-Atlantic dialect mix, or a later dialect mix originating in upstate New York. But where is general American English located today? If we still think it's Midwestern, we need to think again. The language of a large part of the Midwest, centered on the Great Lakes, has been changing rather dramatically over the course of the past few decades. And it no longer sounds very general at all. So let's take a listen to someone from the Great Lakes area, a speaker from Buffalo, New York, and see what we think.
Too hot for hockey. Don and Patty took the bus to the gym to watch some hockey. They met their pals, Dawn and Chad. They snacked on nachos, hot dog, sausage, and pop. They noticed something was odd. The gym was getting hot. Don and Dawn took off their jackets. Patty wiped the sweat with a paper towel. Chad took off his hat and used it as a fan. The puck never hit the ice, which sadly had begun to melt. They couldn't get the gym cool enough. The match was canceled, and the friends headed to the bar to watch the Sox game.
That's not actually very general, is it? Did you hear so she pronounced words like patty, snacked, odd, and hot? Something like patty, snacked, odd, and hat. So if general American English is a regional dialect, it's either moved westward, away from the Midwest, or its geographic area has been curtailed to exclude the Great Lakes region. And it's certainly not an East Coast dialect, not New England or Boston or New York, or Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or the South. These dialects are all too distinctive. So maybe general American English isn't located anywhere. Maybe it's a-regional, having more to do with social class and education than with region. Maybe general American English has more to do with what it's not than what it actually is. Maybe it's speech or writing that's considered dialect-free, free of any pronunciation features allowing us to pinpoint a speaker's regional origins and most definitely free of stigmatized grammatical features like ain't or double negatives. Or maybe general American English is more of an ideal than a reality. Maybe it's the way Americans wish they could talk or feel that they should talk and just never quite achieve. Americans are very concerned with using correct English. And just because American English established a strong presence in the U.S. as the 19th century progressed, as American English reached the West Coast, this doesn't mean that Americans have always been very confident in the way they use language. So just when did Americans finally gain linguistic confidence? When did they turn away from British English language standards toward American norms? The answer is surprisingly gradually and surprisingly late. Now, throughout the 1800s, as they were moving westward, Americans were moving toward their own language standards. You'll recall the influence of such figures as Ben Franklin, Noah Webster, and Mark Twain on establishing and promoting American language standards. But it would take more than a century after the publication of Webster's Dictionary in 1828 for British linguistic influence to really fall away. In fact, the American English pronunciation norm for upper-class educated speech, for formal public speech, for broadcast speech, and for movies was quite British-sounding until after World War II. Maybe it wasn't British per se. There's something called transatlantic English, something of a blend between American English and British English that was used by newsreaders and actors in both England and America in the early days of broadcast media. For example, think of the way Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant speak in a movie like The Philadelphia Story. And even America's leaders, American presidents, sounded British into the World War II years. Let's listen to a few. Here's William McKinley, a clip from a campaign speech given from his front porch in 1896.
My fellow citizens, recent events have imposed upon the patriotic people of this country a responsibility and a duty greater than that of any since the Civil War. Then it was a struggle to preserve the government of the United States. Now it is a struggle to preserve the financial honor of the government.
Next, let's listen to Teddy Roosevelt in the early 1900s, giving a speech explaining why the political bosses of the day oppose his Progressive Party.
The privileged classes, the representatives of special privilege, of special interest, can always make terms with a boss or bosses. They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Republican Party. They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Democratic Party. But they can't make terms with the people.
Finally, let's listen to FDR, a short clip from his 1941 inaugural address.
Most vital to our present and to our future is this experience of a democracy which successfully survived crisis at home, put away many evil things, built new structures on enduring lines, and through it all, maintained the fact of its democracy.
Do their accents sound American or do they sound British? In either case, there's no denying that these presidents sound American, and proudly so, in what they're talking about. And that's always the first step toward achieving genuine linguistic confidence in your nation's own dialect, in achieving an endonormative rather than exonormative orientation. As Americans become proud to be Americans, through the course of the 19th century and into the 20th, they eventually, at least, become proud to speak American English.